As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Okunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Naples has long had a reputation as a mafia hotspot. For a while, there were quarters that tourists just didn't go to. Now, though, bars and restaurants are packed with them. And here's the curious part. Who's running those venues? Many of the same mafiosi.
And Australia has given the world many good things. The best edition of MasterChef, incredibly cute koalas, and, as I'm sure you didn't know, Australia is also credited with the flat white. We take a look at how the cups of foamy goodness came to be. But first, ask a young person for a look at their TikTok or Instagram feeds, and you'll see that their videos reflect their tastes, music they like or some specific hobby, and the algorithms bring you more of what you like. So my timeline is mostly filled with people like Grace Beverly, who runs Tala.
And this all ties into the fact that we demand women to be attractive, and then at the same time we tell them that if they value their looks, they're vapid.
But a young man's timeline may look somewhat different. They're more likely to see videos from someone like Andrew Tate, a misogynistic former kickboxer.
So I think my sister is her husband's property, yes.
Or from Ben Shapiro, a right-wing American commentator.
They say diversity, equity, and inclusion. And what they mean by that is shut up.
And the fact that young men and women see different versions of reality on social media may be one reason why their worldviews are drifting apart.
Two decades ago, there was very little difference between the self-reported political opinions of young men and women in developed countries.
Robert Guest is our deputy editor.
But women are now far more likely than men to self-identify as liberal.
Robert, how do we know this?
We analysed polling data from 20 rich countries. Participants were asked to describe themselves on a scale of 1 to 10 from very liberal to very conservative. And back in 2002, for young men and women, that's between the ages of about 18 and 29, there was negligible difference. But by 2020, the gap had widened to 0.75. Now, that may not sound like much, but that's roughly twice the size of the gap in opinion between people with and without a university degree in the same year. And for America, France, and Poland, the difference was more than one. What seems to be happening is that young women have been getting more liberal and young men have not. Put another way, young women are now 27 percentage points more likely than young men to describe themselves as liberal.
And what are the political consequences of this?
This difference doesn't translate straightforwardly into voting patterns, but there is a difference. So in America, by one estimate, 72% of young women who voted in House elections in 2022 backed the Democratic candidate, while only 54% of young men did. Back in 2008, there was barely any gap at all. You see this very clearly in South Korea, where not so long ago they elected the first overtly anti-feminist president, and that was with very strong backing from young men. In Europe, where elections tend not to be a binary choice, there's usually a wide array of parties, and young women are much more likely to support the most left-wing ones, and young men are much more likely to favour the right or even the radical right. I saw some of this in Poland, where I met some educated young professional women at a trendy food market in Warsaw.
Mostly because of the culture and the religion, that there is a high discrepancy between women and men. And
also, I'm working with building companies.
Okay, sounds like they were having a great time. Robert, what did they tell you?
These were young, university-educated women who were worried that there weren't enough university-educated men of their age in Poland, and that the men there were, it was really difficult to find ones who weren't sexist. They told me stories. For example, one of them said that she had got a pay rise a few years back, and her boyfriend immediately said, "Are you sleeping with your boss?" He's now an ex-boyfriend. One of the other ladies I spoke to talked about going out on Tinder and finding guys saying that chores and childcare were women's work and that women couldn't be leaders. So these guys didn't have a second date. Their complaint was that there seems to be this confluence here of more emancipated values among women and more conservative values among men, and it makes it very hard for them to get on with each other. So it doesn't just mean that they're voting for different parties. And in Poland, there's a party called The Left, which is very high support among young women, while a lot of young men are supporting parties like Confederation, a fairly far-right outfit that's also traditional on its social issues. I mean, one of its slogans is "Against feminists, in defense of real women."
Robert, what do you think is driving this divergence in worldviews?
There are a few likely causes. One is the difference in how men and women have experienced the feminist revolution of the past couple of generations. Women have made enormous strides in the workplace, and that's wonderful. And by and large, in the rich world, college-educated men are very happy with this. There's a group, though, who are not doing so well, which is principally the less educated men in rich countries. Now, the days when you could get a decent job that would make women want to marry you just by being strong have disappeared. Now, if you're not doing very well in school, and men are much more highly represented at the bottom of the educational scale than women are, then these guys, they've lost status compared to what they think that their fathers had. They haven't got particularly good jobs, and they're finding it quite hard to find romance. So that means that the two groups are experiencing things differently. Young women tend to correctly bank all the progress that's been made with feminism and say, yes, and now we need to deal with the remaining obstacles. There's a group of young men who are saying, actually, it's become so that it's unfair to men now, that feminism has gone so far that our opportunities are being obstructed. And you're seeing more young men believing this in rich countries than old men do. And that's very different from what you would normally assume. You normally assume the older generation are more conservative than the young ones. But this is much more vital for the younger generation because they've got their whole lives ahead of them. So a lot of them are very angry, and right-wing politicians are figuring out ways of courting this group, of attracting their votes, while politicians on the left are quite often acting as if these guys don't have any legitimate complaints at all.
And did you meet any of these young men when you were in Poland?
Yeah, we were out in the countryside and we talked to some young farmers, and I was talking to one of them as he was fixing his tractor, and he was complaining that his previous girlfriend had left him to go and live in a town because she said that the farm didn't smell very nice.
Wie pani, kiedyś ludziom mniej zapach przeszkadzał, zwierzęta.
And, you know, he's saying, look, I just wanted the traditional, stable lifestyle like previous generations had, but she wanted fun. This is such a common problem in the Polish countryside that actually the variation of the British reality show Farmer Wants a Wife is one of the most popular shows in the country, because it's just widely understood that the much better educated young Polish women don't want to marry farmers. They're also not that keen on blue-collar workers.
Is there any hope for men and women to be drawn back together?
I wouldn't want to overstate the scale of the problem here. I mean, there's still ultimately very strong things that pull men and women together. But it is a problem if they can't get along together. And it is a problem if you have a significant group of people feeling alienated from society, especially if they're young and male, because, I mean, historically, that's been the most dangerous group in any society. And it's also a problem if they're starting to support demagogues, which we see they are in a number of countries. I think the most practical thing that policymakers can do is think harder about how schools are currently failing underperforming boys. And some ideas that do seem to work include hiring more male teachers, who are just almost non-existent in primary schools in rich countries now. Another idea is possibly to have boys start school a year later by default, since they mature more slowly than girls do. There could also be a beefing up of vocational training, ideally to prepare young men for occupations that they currently shun, like those involving health, education or administrative tasks, all of which likely to be bigger in the future. If those kind of reforms help lift up some of the boys who are struggling and help them adjust to a world which is correctly changing, that would benefit both men and women.
Robert, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
For decades, Naples has been notoriously riddled with crime.
Around 40 people have been arrested by Italian police in a major operation against the Camorra, or Naples Mafia. All those held are...
From murder and extortion to petty crime to a rubbish collection problem so big it led to a state of emergency, most of it is associated with the clans of the Camorra, a criminal organization with a pedigree going back to the 17th century. But in recent years, at last, things have cleaned up, or changed anyway.
Naples is a lot safer than it once was. There was a time when some parts of the city were almost no-go areas.
John Hooper is The Economist's Italy and Vatican correspondent.
I remember a Neapolitan who lived abroad who went into the quartieri spagnoli, as they're called. Nothing happened to him in there until he came out. Wanted the time, looked at his watch, no watch. Pickpocketing, muggings, bag snatching were rife in these areas. And nowadays, you can find plenty of tourists, restaurants full, bars full. And it's reflective of a bigger change in the criminal activity of the city.
How do you mean? What's changed about the criminal end?
Essentially, the gangland violence has diminished. If you look at the figures for killings, for example, over the last 10 years, 2013, 34 killings associated with the local mafia, the Camorra. 2023, that figure is down to 10. Attempted murders, 17 down to 4. So it looks as if organized criminals are committing less crime of all kinds.
And in turn, why is that?
It's partly because of policing. A lot of the older bosses have been imprisoned over the last 10 to 20 years. The other development that has helped has been that the Camorra appears to have formed into two big blocks. And that has kept the lid on turf wars, because if you think about it, if you have many different gangs, then the chances are much higher of them contrasting in some way and ending up with violent disputes. But having said all that, the figures compiled by the body that tackles organized crime in Italy show that Naples and nearby Caserta have the highest density of mafia penetration anywhere in Italy. When I spoke to the chief district anti-mafia prosecutor, Rosa Volpe, she told me organized crime here hasn't diminished. It's evolved.
Aha. Evolved into what, though?
She points to three overlapping categories of the Camorra in Naples and its surrounds. There are those who are still practicing extortion above all, but also drug trafficking, prostitution, etc. Then there are the so-called baby gangs, who are often the sons of those imprisoned older bosses. And They've been charged by them to keep control of the territory that they left when they were jailed. But then there's a final category, which is those who have been involved in all of the above, but now have a great deal of money, which they need to be able to launder. And that's where a lot of the Camorra's activity has moved to, money laundering.
But laundering it how? Where?
In many cases, what they have done is to go abroad, to get out of Italy altogether. But those who've remained have often invested in bars, in restaurants, in accommodation that can be used for short-term rentals for tourists. And that diversifies their risk, because if you invest in several bars and one of them is seized by the authorities, well, you've still got all the others. You've got to remember that street crime is bad for business if you're in the tourist business. And that has encouraged the traditional Camorra to stop the activities of petty criminals, hence the greater safety in some of the most notorious areas of the city.
Right. So if I go as a tourist and I get an Airbnb and I go to a bar and I go to a restaurant, I might well be aiding and abetting a money laundering operation, but I won't have my watch nicked, I guess is the idea here. Like, broadly, this is a force for good?
It's a real moral dilemma, because is money laundering socially useful? It often can be. But the point that the law enforcement agents make is that this is dirty money. And when gangsters become business people, they can pollute the legal business environment. So there is still a lot of criminality within the city that is going unchecked and unseen. A further risk arises from what I mentioned earlier, the formation of these two big blocks, because although that is acting as a lid on the violence for the moment, were those two blocks to fall out, then you could have a situation similar to what happened in Sicily, in Palermo, back in the 1980s, a really catastrophic mafia war that would leave large numbers of bodies on the street.
Thanks very much for your time, John.
My pleasure.
On any given day in Shoreditch, a trendy part of London's East End, you'll see flurries of hipsters clutching artfully designed takeaway cups. This month, thousands of caffeine lovers descended on the area for the London Coffee Festival. Many of the visitors opted for flat whites, a drink popular among those who want to taste the coffee beans rather than temper them.
I love flat whites, probably my go-to. Unlike big, big half-litre cups, the flat white, I guess, is just the perfect balance, really.
That gives you all of the coffee flavour without too much foam that you can handle.
I think it's a really good drink to try to get into espresso. So it's sort of like a gateway drug.
For making the perfect flat white, you obviously need espresso. We start by grinding the coffee into the portafilter. And now we are going to extract the coffee for 28 seconds. Once we have a perfect shot ready, we will proceed with steaming our milk. Now the key to a good flat white is a very thin layer of microfoam. And there we have the perfect flat white.
Flat whites are powerful yet smooth. They're enjoyed in many parts of the world, other than London, of course. But not many people know about their origins.
The flat white is believed to have originated in Australia and New Zealand in the 1980s. Imogen White writes about culture for The Economist.
It stands up alongside Vegemite and Avo toast as one of the region's great exports. Not bad for an area which took time to get to grips with a good cup of coffee.
Tell me a bit more about that. What are the origins of coffee down under?
Well, Australian coffee making prowess is a fairly recent phenomenon. Tea was the preferred beverage for British settlers in the 18th century. Because of that, no one seemed to know how to make a decent cup of coffee. They tended to boil their beans instead of roasting them. And to improve taste, people added the bitter chicory plant instead of things that you would now, like sugar. During my reporting, I found one academic who had uncovered a letter to a newspaper that was dated 1939. And in it, a man was complaining that Australian coffee is something that punishes the drinker.
But we've gone quite away from Australian coffee being punishing to sip to becoming a worldwide sensation.
Yeah, that's right. And this was kind of a process that began during the Second World War when American servicemen who were stationed in the Pacific arrived and they refused to drink the coffee that was on offer. Later, Greek and Italian immigrants arrived after the war and they brought with them expertise. And then in the 1950s, commercial espresso makers reached the country. Peter Bancroft, a young lad, had tasted his first proper coffee on a holiday in London. And with the help of his father, he began importing Italian machines to their cafe in Melbourne. And it all took off from there.
And how is Australia's coffee industry faring today?
Australia's cafes take in $10 billion Australian dollars, or $6.6 billion US dollars per year, the most per person of any country outside Europe. 95% of the country's 14,000 cafes are independently owned. Interestingly, Australia is one of the few markets in which Starbucks failed. In terms of beans, the country has an unfavourable climate for coffee plants, so it imports far more than it sells. But as well as New Zealand, it still claims the flat white as its own. In the past year, one in three British customers ordered the beverage. Pret alone has sold 8 million in the past year. Americans are increasingly sipping too. And at COP, the Australian Pavilion has become a social hub, not because of the country's green credentials, but because of the barista the delegation brings along.
Imogen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ore.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.